This is Remote Ruby.
Have you any remote ideas to the meaning of the word?
What's up?
Hello.
Hey.
How's it going?
It's going. I had a lot happen last week that had nothing to do with programming that just made my life annoying. Like losing power because a branch ripped the meter off my house. So I'm pretty glad to be back this week.
Yeah. How long did it take them to get that fixed?
I called my utility company. They were out here in 10 minutes. My utility company,
wow,
they have a really bad reputation for like dealing with like billing and stuff. But when it comes to getting someone out here, they're amazing. He's like, hey, I can't do anything with this. It was like an 18-foot branch that fell.
He's like, you're going to have to grab both ends of this power cable and fix it yourself.
I'm like COVID conscious. And he's like, I don't bite. Come closer. And I was like, oh, okay. But also there's like live power lines in my driveway. But yeah, he was like, yeah, I can't put this box back on. You're an electrician. So I called two of them. Both booked to the middle of November. It was like October 16th, 15th, last Friday. And so I was like, well, that's not good. So called another person. They were like, let me see if I can get someone out there. And then he came out and was like, yeah, I can't just give you a new meter because your house isn't up to code. Yeah, he was like, it would pass an inspection. It's grandfathered in terms of existing, but I can't do any active work to it like this. Like I can't install it like it was. So I had to get a new breaker box. They had to move the meter to the other side of the house, the other side of the garage. It's not that far. But then it was like putting junction boxes in and running cables. Very like pricey job. And he was like, by the way, I had a job canceled today, so I can do it today, but you have to tell me in 30 minutes because otherwise my guys are going to go home. And I was like, I'm going to need 29 minutes to like figure out this. And so pulled the trigger and I lost power at 9:30 that morning and 8:20 that night it came back on.
That's super impressive. Knowing that electricians are booked out for that long and while we're building a house, so we know a bit of the like the trades right now are crazy booked out for anything. So for you to be able to get that solved that fast, that's amazing.
It was worth the pain of giving them my credit card. It was like, it's okay.
It was worth the pain of you unknowingly paying triple because he knew you were in an emergency and he was like, I'm going to take advantage of these people.
I was like on the phone with my dad. I know nothing about this stuff. Is this, am I getting screwed over here? And he's like, I don't know what to tell you. Anyway, I feel good about it. So
hopefully you're up to code until the next person comes by and is like, that's not up to code either.
It's not up to code. They offer a lifetime warranty on like their work and like a 5-year parts warranty. So I was like, okay. But also I had a homeowner's insurance claim denied 2 days before that for like mold damage. And so basically like Saturday, I went in my driveway and like I saw a nail and I spent the next hour like picking anything sharp about the driveway. And Shannon's like, what are you doing? And like, we cannot afford another, like we can't blow a tire. I can't do anything else. So
I just blew a tire. You do not want to do that. I ran over a nail or something too.
You should come over to my house because basically they brought in all this rock around the foundation and underneath the garage floors and all that. But I swear every square inch of that house has nails and other like tacks and other things like just laying outside. And I'm like surprised that I haven't stepped on anything yet, but there are nails everywhere. So if you want to go and make all those tires equally brand new, come on down. I won't charge you anything.
How is that process going?
Actually, before you get into that, Brooke just went to take the dog out to potty and she calls me from outside. She's, hey, there's like a bubble in the front yard. And I'm like, what are you talking about? And so I go upstairs and you hear running water. And there's a 3-foot like circle of grass that's clearly like an inch or so higher than the grass around
it. I've seen that online before.
Yeah. And they just like aerated the ground and stuff and dug those plugs out or whatever. But yeah, they went around and tried to flag all the irrigation spots. And I think they missed one. And so now it's just leaking water out there. Yeah. The house process is at an exciting point because the framers are getting done and there's still some things they got to fix, but like we poured the front porch, which means they can finish the front porch roof that'll stick out from the house. The shingles are all up. They're waiting to finish the metal roof when the porch, because the front porch will have a metal roof on it. So that's almost done. So all the windows are starting to arrive and they somehow got these 5x5 windows drug up 30 some feet in the air and installed them. And I'm doing a little micromanagement of, hey, we're using this whole like zip system stuff. So like, don't take shortcuts with it because I want my house to be like watertight for 100 years. They're like using the wrong tape for the windows because the corners of the windows is where like water can get in. So got this nice, fancy, expensive stretch tape that they can do. So I'm like trying to keep an eye on that, but they're doing that. The fireplaces should be going in. Doors should be going in really soon. It's starting to become an enclosed box. Garage doors, maybe even two. I think those got ordered. And then HVAC is going in. So they've been running ducting upstairs and all that. So it's starting to be, the exterior is not finished, but finished enough that like it can be enclosed and then they can start working on the stone and brick and the hardy board panels and hopefully get that done before winter. We just got the engineering drawing for the city approved for the pool, or it was at least submitted to the city, but the HOA approved it. So I don't know if the city approved it yet. I think they will. And then the pool can get craned in or moved in and whatever before it starts to snow. And yeah, it's just this weird moment of all the people we've known working on it are about to, we'll never see them again. And a new crew will come in, or like three different new crews, because we're going to end up having people doing the flooring and hopefully cabinets won't take too much longer and start going in after that. And the drywall crew and whatever else. So yeah, it is now though, like all of the tile estimates and the plumbing estimates and all those are coming in, and we've already spent all of the money that we put for our down payment and the construction loan. So now the interest payments are starting to come in, but thankfully it's been $100 and $200 for the first 2 months. So hopefully it doesn't get crazy by the end of this before we switch the mortgage, but it's changing. That's for sure. It's like starting to feel like a house now that you get windows in. It really feels different.
I had a, and I quote, $1 billion business idea while I was listening to you talk about your house. And I'm going to give it away
to me?
To everyone.
So generous.
Instead, as an alternative to shingles, what if you took Pringles and put them in a pottery kiln, solidified them, and built shingles that way?
And because they're made out of potatoes, this could provide power for the house, right?
Do you really think that Pringles are made out of potatoes, my friend? The other day, someone told me something that made me very upset. And they were like, have you ever had burnt meat from Taco Bell? And I was like, no. And they're like, it's because it's not meat. And I was like, dang it.
Did you hear about the whole sand in the Taco Bell meat?
No. Don't tell me I like Taco Bell.
There was like a thing going around a couple of years ago that was like, there's sand in your Taco Bell meat. And in the Taco Bell website, under like the FAQ somewhere, it was like, is there, and they wouldn't say sand, obviously, but it was like, is there whatever stuff in the meat? And they were like, well, this is kind of a natural thing and it's going to be in meat and whatever. I'll see if I can find that again, because I was like, that was hilarious. But I agree. It's, Pringles are like some sort of, they're like OSB, like potato sawdust, like solidified into a chip.
It's a goo. It's made by a goo, man.
The spicy potato taco at Taco Bell.
It's a man of culture.
Mm.
It's weird.
Yeah.
I miss their caramel apple empanadas.
Oh my gosh. I tried to order one the other day because I didn't know they discontinued them. And they like laughed at me. They're like, we haven't had those in 2 years. And so I just sped out of the parking lot in my minivan. And then I drove back through because I was hungry. But yeah.
Real fan.
Freaking so good and so sad. We may never even get to Ruby. The only time I've ever led a activist campaign. I started a Facebook group when Burger King got rid of the cheesy tots a long time ago. And I never advertised. I got like 600 people in that group. And you know what? Years later, they brought them back.
Respect plus 10. That's pretty cool. Is there sand in Taco Bell meat? Yep, we'll include that in the show notes. I heard it's not actually, it's literally just powder that they mix with something and it turns into meat.
It's like 3D printing.
Yeah, exactly.
I honestly feel a little bit better about that.
What have you been working on this week? Any interesting things?
I have two things I'd like to mention. And I'm going to start with the Ruby one instead of the JavaScript one.
The shit.
Dang it.
JavaScript.
When I started working with Kyle Fox, the first question I asked him was, do you pronounce it JavaScript or JavaScript? I don't remember the answer. But okay, so the Ruby thing, we have, I guess, like an interesting problem of like, we need to quickly delete a record, but it has associations that have associations and they have callbacks. So like, we can't say dependent delete all in the associations. Dependent delete all will just run like a delete command with SQL and it's very fast. Dependent destroy will instantiate each relation and call destroy, so callbacks get run. So we have looked at this problem before, and the thing we thought we'd try next would be Rails has an option now. It's dependent destroy async. So if a post has many comments, like a comment has a destroy callback, then when you say to destroy async, what it'll do is destroy the record and then enqueue a background job to destroy each dependent, like each associated record. Sounds like a dream, right? Unless you use foreign key relationships. So if I call destroy on the parent and the child record has a foreign key to that record, it won't let destroy happen on the parent because it's still being referenced.
Yeah. Oh, no. Yeah, that's funny. Because I thought the same thing too of the destroy async when they got announced. I was like, oh, this is smart. I'll use this on any big thing. Great point. Didn't Jason Searles tweet something about this not that long ago about foreign keys for this exact reason where they were like, sometimes more of a pain than they, you know, like you really want your data to be correct in your database, but at the same time, like they introduce problems as well. So it's not as magic bullet, just like N+1 queries. If you're using Russian doll caching, it's actually a worse performance because you now have to query for more records every time than you need if you're doing Russian doll caching. And I thought that was an interesting point. And this reminded me of that.
Yeah, I'll have to look for that Searles tweet because that sounds very appropriate. But it's like
Justin Searles. I said Jason, didn't I?
It's all right.
You did.
Life happens.
I'm looking at Jason and I'm saying Jason.
I appreciate it. So we ran into this and it's like, we could remove the foreign key definition constraint, but do we want to do that? And it's like, I don't know. What we are exploring, what I've been exploring today is there, I may have talked about it before, there's a gem called Miss Hannigan. We've explored this problem at Podia and we've looked at this gem. Basically, what it'll do is one of the dependent options in Rails for associations is nullify, which will, on the child, set the foreign key ID to just be null. And what the Miss Hannigan gem does, it's really small. It's one Ruby file that does everything. It adds a dependent option called nullify then purge. So under the hood, what it does is actually set up like has many, we'll say comments, dependent, nullify. And then after destroy, it will enqueue a cleanup job, which is destroy async. It will just go through and call destroy, but it's less of your problem because it's in the background. It's not like blocking a request. That's a simpler trade-off to me because oftentimes when I do foreign keys, I will put a not null, but instead of having to relax the foreign key, all I have to do is relax the null constraint. And That works. And the nice thing about that is with destroy AC, I don't know this, I'm kind of spitballing here, but like in my head, if something goes wrong with a background job, you restart whatever, you lose the background job for whatever reason, you can end up with records that are referencing relationships that don't exist. Where like, if I'm going to nullify it and then the job fails, I can always just clean up and trust that anything that's null can be deleted, like in the foreign key. So
That's a good point. And there's like another kind of approach is like soft delete it and then queue it up for permanent deletion kind of thing. Could be another option that's very similar, where instead of nulling it, you would just make it soft delete it and then delete it 7 days later or something.
We have kind of a homegrown solution, and that's what we're doing right now, is we have a module, it's like AC destroyable, and it'll just set deleted at on the record and then enqueue the background. The thing I'm trying to avoid with that is like, then you have to update scopes and stuff to look for deleted at. But yeah, that is a very like valid solution that has worked for us so far. I'm just trying to see, can we like maybe slice off some of that like dotting scopes, things like that.
Yeah, because it's so hard to like decide whether or not a soft delete should be included in the default scope, because you end up with gotchas no matter which way you go. If you don't include it, then you're likely to make a mistake, and sometimes a deleted record could get shown if you missed it for whatever reason. And then of course the other direction is, well, if you always include it, then like that's going to be frustrating in other ways, and like your admin and other things will have to kind of undo that. I don't know. This is interesting as a high level discussion too. I think we've all noticed a lot of teams that ship a product and they're like really fast, and then it slows down over time. And you wonder like what happened with their engineering team, and like, why can't they get any new features out the door? And I feel like there's a lot of these things where you build the app and you're like, I'll never have to worry about destroying dependent records and that being an issue of any kind. Cause like that's a solved problem. This is just built into Active Record. Voila, it's magic. But it really does become like these weird little things that end up being really problematic over time, where you're like, look, this person now has several hundred thousand tweets or followers or whatever, and they disappeared and deleted their account. So now what do we got to do? What do we do with all these old tweets? And like, lots of things start to just break down over time, I feel like. And it's an interesting challenge because you can't usually predict those things before they become a problem.
Well, it kind of gets back to something that when I was working with Nate Hopkins that he was super, super big on and kind of instilled in me, is that at the end of the day, the more work and thought you put into your data architecture, the easier it is going to be to like modify and do things later. So if you put in all that work up front and your data is very well architected, it's very clean and understandable, and it works for what y'all need. And of course, things expand and scopes change over time. But if you build it right and well the first time, then I don't think you'll end up in that situation. It's just how important it is to set up your relationships. Do a lot of thought up front in architecting your database. It's super important to the velocity of your team in the future.
When Chris was talking about, there's questions around like if you do like soft deletion, setting it up, how do you scope it? I referenced our one true reference, Laravel, which ships with a soft deleting trait out of the box. And when you have a model that is soft deleted, they're automatically excluded from query results.
So you could make that yourself. You could monkey patch Active Record to do that.
You could.
Are you telling people to monkey patch things? I thought
No, I just monkey patch Image Magic. So I'm down to monkey patch Active Record.
To me, that seems like the better default of the two. Of if you have soft delete, then it probably should just be excluded by default. And that's one of those situations like multi-tenancy where you never want to leak data that was deleted or from somebody else's tenant. So like you want to have a pretty big hammer there that is going to do the right thing out of the box and not have to like, you know, worry about every little query that you do.
So that's my Ruby thought for the week. So I've been working on.
Here's my question for y'all. And I have my own opinion on this, but is it okay to just use the default scope? I mean, I try not to use a default scope ever. And in general, I would preferably opt to like just include that always in the query. And yeah, sometimes we miss it, but that's whatever. Because I feel like you jam yourself into like a corner with that default scope.
I have to have a very compelling reason to want to use a default scope. Maybe it's soft delete, like that kind of borders it a little bit, but for the most part, I'm kind of like you.
Yeah, and I think it's similar discussion to callbacks in your models.
Right.
It's one of those things where look at Hotwire, broadcasting changes in callbacks is obviously probably the best place for it because anytime anything changes, every client can know about it. So like there's not benefit to adding some sort of like wrapper around your model that adds those things when you could just use callbacks. But that's not a great solution for a lot of things, and that's fine. So it's the same kind of thing. It's also one of those situations too where like day one, slapping soft delete exclusion on your default scope might make sense. And then over time, there's some like request from somebody that kind of conflicting or something with that. You've got to go change it. And you can always start and refactor and change it to whatever you need. Because I think a lot of people end up doing that anyways, like when they do stuff in callbacks and it's like, oh, turns out I can't do that every single time. So we'll just make a method on the model that does both or something. Ryan Bates had the Stripe screencast or something that was the first time I'd ever seen like a similar method to save. And it was like save with payment. And all it did was say like, if the record's valid, we're going to then attempt Stripe. And if that's successful, we'll save it in the database. Otherwise, we'll return the errors because it wasn't valid. Or if Stripe failed, we'll return that error. And I was like, oh, that's nice. You can kind of make your own save method that extends save, but it doesn't like override it or anything. It just extends it. And we call this method now instead. We don't replace the active record save and we're not having to call super and all this stuff. We just have our new method and we just agreed to use that.
I was about to ask, like, how do you even build a Rails app without callbacks? But that's a great example of one way where you could replace something with a callback. I got roasted at RailsConf one year for all the callbacks in my app, and I still think about that day a lot.
I was going to say, I've had thoughts about this. We use the Whisper Gym at Podia for like event broadcasting. Really. So like essentially you'll put around actions on controllers. You add these like subscribers and they're just classes that listen for events. And so Whisper has like an active record side where it'll like broadcast events like created, updated, deleted. And so you define these methods and these subscribers. So if I had like a blog post and I updated it, if I had in the subscriber a method called like blog post updated, that method would get fired if that event was fired.
I do that too.
Okay, yeah.
With Kafka, not with this. But yeah, I do the pretty much the same thing.
Apparently, before my time, Rails had some kind of system or library in place built into Rails to do this kind of thing. And I don't know when it got removed, or maybe I'm misunderstanding. Maybe it didn't do that. But I often think, man, I wish that was still there.
We'll have to ask our Ruby historian if that was ever a thing.
Yeah. He'll be able to find it.
Put him on the spot, that live podcast recording.
I just want to give a quick shout out to our sponsor, Honey Badger. They're a single platform for error monitoring, uptime monitoring, and cron monitoring. I've blown away several people because of the real-time error monitoring with Honey Badger. I've caught an error and fixed it before the customer could even email me and say that something was wrong. They get pretty blown away by that experience, and it always makes my day. So thanks to Honey Badger for making that even possible. Star Josh and Ben created Honey Badger as a 100% bootstrapped monitoring solution. Without investors breathing down their necks, they can spend all their time making a better product for you, the developer. So check them out at honeybadger.io and let them know you heard about them on Remote Ruby. So you reminded me of a little thing I was doing this week that was related to callbacks. So the notice gem, like when you send a notification out, we have some callbacks that you can like use if you wanted to. For example, like if you want to record that a notification was sent successfully, like a text message, you could use the callback and say, oh, okay, the Twilio SMS went out. Here's the ID. We'll save it in some logs or whatever. We're implementing AppNotic, which is a gem for sending Apple push notifications. And the Apple push notification service, they have some non-HTTP2 version where you actually like send the notifications and they don't tell you if it was delivered or not. And you have to use this feedback service to actually ask them for stuff that failed. So basically, if I try and send a notification to your phone, but you deleted my app, then Apple will get mad at you if you continue trying to send notifications to that token that doesn't exist. And then you need to basically use that feedback service and remove it. So we were like looking at some options for that because, you know, I didn't really want to have people run another service. That would be another dyno you'd have to run on Heroku or whatever and pay for. And it was like, that seems a little overkill. So we found AppNotic uses HTTP2, which will actually send you those feedbacks in line there. And you like set up a connection pool and stuff. And it's kind of automated for you, which is nice. But I need some way for the notification to let you know when a token failed. And so I was like, huh, maybe we'll call a method on your notification to like, here's a failed token, you can clean it up however you want. And I implemented that and I was like, oh, this is fine. This works pretty well. But we could add some callback there that was like, well, we tried to send the notification and it failed. We have a callback specifically for that that you could register. And I've been using the active support notifications. And for whatever reason, it never crossed my mind that those don't yield arguments to your callback. It's like, it's the object itself. So it would be the notification where like your active record callbacks, you just give it a symbol and it calls the method with that name. Or you can do a proc or lambda and it will yield the active record object or instance. And I realized if I did it that way, we'd have to like store in an instance variable all of the failed tokens, then call the callback and then just assume you knew how to call that method. Where I thought it might be easier if it was like, hey, we're going to give you the individual token and call a method instead in that situation. But it was kind of interesting because it was like, feels like a callback because we're registering this thing that will get called kind of asynchronously from the HTTP2 connection. And then somehow we got to surface that and send it back to your notification to say, hey, you might want to fix this for next time. And it was one of those times where I think we're just going to use the method that we call and you just implement something, but and no callbacks, because it seemed better for us to just say, here, we call this method with the failed token. You figure out how to handle it rather than here's a callback when a token fails. But I don't know. It's kind of interesting. Seems like two similar approaches, the same problem, but.
Right. It also reminded me, there's a similar thing I haven't looked at. It's Rails event store. And it's like kind of a similar thing, except so like with Whisper, we define like a controller level usually, but you can do it kind of anywhere. I think the event store one is you define listeners like an application level and they call classes. Like you give it like an instance of a class that knows how to like, is a handler. That's kind of interesting too. It makes me want to explore this a little more. But also, I'm also like, maybe a callback's fun. I don't know.
That reminds me a little bit of the like Stripe event gem where you register the webhooks that you want to process.
It's exactly like that.
Yeah, because I took that approach. And this is what the Rails instrumentation stuff uses, where you can say like, here's a SQL query that Active Record ran. And just, it gives you the query and like, the details about it, and you can use it for keeping track of metrics if you want to send that over to some service or just log it somewhere or whatever. And that's actually how the Stripe event gem processes webhooks. So it receives the webhook and says it's of whatever type, and it uses that as the name of the event with the same active support like instrumentation implementation for that. And then you can register as many listeners as you want for those messages. I ended up using that same approach for pay, where rather than Stripe event was good, but I didn't have an equivalent for Braintree or Paddle or whatever. So took that approach, made it a bit more generic and just prefix all those event types with Paddle or Braintree or Stripe. And then you can register your listeners for individual ones. But Yeah, very similar, where it's kind of, it's a bit more JavaScript-y approach to things because it's running it like asynchronously.
We're getting deep here.
Your JavaScript reminded me of something that I wanted to talk about real quick, sure. Which was, did you guys realize that imports are hoisted in JavaScript?
Nope.
I don't know what a hoisted means, so I never thought about it.
Okay. Well, this is really relevant.
I'm brutally honest.
I could intuit that it was happening, but I never explicitly stopped and noticed it or had to. So the idea with hoisting is that when you have a file of JavaScript and you have imports and code like mixed in between, all of the imports are run before your code actually runs. So that means that if you, for example, somebody asked, how do I use jQuery ES build? And I was like, oh, you just do the same thing you would do like in Webpack, where you import jQuery and you say window $sign equals jQuery. That does not work like you would expect it to, because if you have an import after those window.$ lines of code run, that import will be moved to the top. And then the imports will run. For example, if you have a jQuery plugin like jQuery UI, the imports get
hoisted. You might want to stop and explain what jQuery is for Andrew.
What's jQuery?
Sorry.
What's prototype JS?
I don't know what that is either.
And sorry,
while you're on it,
Scriptaculous.
What's Backbone? I'm sorry, I'm just a child.
It's interesting because that whole thing is you import jQuery and then your code appears that it's going to run the window assignments before it does to your jQuery UI or whatever jQuery plugin. And then it gets to the plugin part and it's, hey, jQuery isn't defined. And you're like, what? And that's because of hoisting. But it can import all of those asynchronously, download them asynchronously, but it will actually still execute the imports in the same order, which is nice. But it doesn't break anything except for when you're writing code in between your imports. And that's, I think, the same reason that like your CSS imports have to be at the top of the file and not like mixed in later. So similar idea, but I didn't know that. And that caught me a little off guard when somebody was like, hey, jQuery works, but like jQuery UI doesn't. Regardless, those are like not ES module compatible and stuff. So like if you try and use jQuery UI from node modules, don't expect it to work. But the easy solution is just go to jQuery UI, download a custom build, which puts all of the plugins that you want, and then you just drop it in your asset pipeline and you're fine. Because they have like a dynamic loading where it would try and require other files automatically like when the page loads. So that's why you grab a file with everything in it instead.
Yeah, I know how you can fix this though.
By writing an ES module compatible version of jQuery, please?
Nice. Very close. It's very close to what I was thinking. I was thinking just delete jQuery out of your app.
Wrong.
Oh, come on.
I have heard that it makes all my JavaScript browser compatible, and I would like it to work on Firefox 1.5.
I haven't used jQuery intentionally in so long, but I will still fight for it.
What?
I mean, there's so many apps that still use it, and I mean, can you imagine how many jQuery plugins are out there right now? There's got to be
a lot.
It's hard to find libraries. It should tell you how impactful it is, and it's still hard to search. You have to explicitly say JavaScript in your search terms to not get jQuery answers.
When you go to Stack Overflow and you're like, how do I query select this thing? And if you have 10 jQuery examples and then like one vanilla JavaScript one later on.
And it's got like -4 votes.
Yeah.
You guys are really triggering me. I've had to rewrite jQuery libraries to try to make them work in like a module system. And oh my God, it's just the worst thing to ever be in a thing.
I don't want to mix and match. I'm either all jQuery or no.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah.
Which is why
I can get behind that.
I still fight for it. I owe so much to jQuery. It made me be able to write JavaScript a lot quicker than I probably would have without it.
Is it weird to think back on like some old code of mine that was written in CoffeeScript that used jQuery? That really sounds funny these days, where you're like, you were using jQuery to like make it browser compatible. And then you were using CoffeeScript, so you didn't have to write terrible JavaScript.
I loved CoffeeScript so much, but I probably wrote my absolute worst JavaScript code in CoffeeScript. One of the last CoffeeScript projects I worked on was Backbone, jQuery, and CoffeeScript, all like as one thing I was doing. So I messed with yet another
JIT
bundler pack. Shit. Another, I don't, we'll call it like bundler. And it's not one that is in JS bundling for Rails, but I made it work with JS bundling and it was awesome. So,
can I guess which one?
Please.
Was it Parcel?
It was Parcel. I saw the tweet. There's a tweet the other day about how version 2 just came out. And I haven't looked at Parcel in a long time. And it was like, hey, the compiling happens in Rust and uses all the cores on your computer. And it's got kind of that like batteries included mindset. So like React just works, stuff like that. And so what I did was I use Inertia.js in this project and I cannot get Inertia to work how I want because ESBuild doesn't have dynamic imports. And Chris, I know you're very aware of that because you wrote the plugin for it. So I thought I'll give Parcel a try. And while Parcel also doesn't have dynamic imports, it has a package that's like a first party Parcel package that will let you like glob. So you can be like import star as something from a folder. And that's exactly what I needed because I could import all my Inertia pages that way and then resolve them out of it. But Parcel is awesome. All I had to do was, and it's fast and it kind of feels like you expect using Rails. So all I had to do is yarn add Parcel. It is one package. When I install JS bundling, my build script runs Parcel. I point it to app JavaScript application.js and I have it output to app assets builds. It does CSS and JavaScript for me. It automatically gives me hot module reloading. It also gives me watching. So if I save a file, it will automatically like reload stuff for me. So I think there was maybe like one other config I had to do. But because JS bundling was installed, like I get all the goodies of the asset pipeline that I would have gotten using ESBuild with JS bundling Rails.
Wow.
And yeah, it's fast. Maybe not as fast as ESBuild, but it's still very fast.
Wow. When you compare it to Webpack, I'm sure it's... Yeah, I'll have to try that out. And that seems like a good one to make another PR to JS bundling for adding. Probably pretty simple install script.
Yeah. I was hoping to write a blog post and maybe try and PR it. What it's like Parcel's designed for is you can give it an HTML file and it'll go through and look for like script and link tags and automatically do it that way, which is super cool. But here I thought working with JS bundling, the pattern is go look for app JavaScript application.js. So
when I think the big thing with Parcel is that it has a built-in HTML processing, but the others don't. They're all plugins.
It says, I'm on their website, it is 10 to 20 times faster than other Java-based script tools. It's written in Rust. Yeah, and it handles like JSX out of the box. Like I don't have to do any transpiling for that. Because before what I tried to do was actually do JS bundling with Webpack, and I realized how much I just don't know about Webpack without Webpacker. So, but it's got tree shaking, minification, image optimization, compression, splitting. Like it does all the things. So it's worth a look.
That's cool. Yeah, I think we do have this separate JS and CSS bundling libraries, but there's so much overlap in those sometimes that like I can definitely see several cases of like even the ESBuild, you can import your CSS and everything and it will output that. And so you don't have to use both. It's nice if you want to use the Tailwind CLI like we do in Jumpstart, that makes perfect sense there. But it's also been one of those cases where if someone accidentally imports CSS in like their tooltips controller and they import the tippy CSS or something, then ESBuild will be like, cool. And then override like the Tailwind CSS or whatever. So yeah, it's an interesting one where they can overlap so much and also they can be totally separate at the same time. So I think that'll be a really good one to add to JS bundling. I do miss the hot reloading. It's just nice when you're like fiddling with a stimulus controller or something and you just want to hit save and watch it update and not have to jump back and forth and refresh the page and whatnot. So I wish some of those things were in ESBuild, but I understand that like his intention is very clear that he wants performance and speed and stuff. And it's definitely done a good job on that. But some of that ends up with some trade-offs where we don't get a feature like that soon. Because I'm sure that he would add it if it wasn't like going to add a ton of complexity or whatever. Parcel looks cool. It seems similar to Vite in a way, I guess, with a lot of the functionality it adds.
It's pretty similar. The thing I think is the main difference is that Parcel does its own like building, where like Vite uses ESBuild and development and roll up in production.
Yeah, I always thought that was kind of surprising when I found that out about Vite. And I was like, so what does Vite do? Is this like duct taping them together or something and trying to make them like similar enough so that development mirrors production at least as much as you can? I don't know.
Yeah, that is my thoughts for the week.
Has there been any updates to the whole, I know PropShaft, like when we talked about Ryan Bates and the comments on that with the asset images and in, I guess, the asset pipeline and in PropShaft. Is that updated at all? Do you know? I feel like it's a fairly missing piece at the moment. And I was looking to see too, I know you can have ESBuild take a file and output it, where we could basically have ESBuild import your images and spit out the assets. And it looked like there was maybe on PropShaft only, like a .digested extension you can add, that it would skip adding a digest to it, if I remember right.
The issue was closed and a PR was merged and the issue is now resolved.
Nice. That's good. I'll have to go look at how it works and play with it. Because I think, I don't know, it sounded like PropShaft was a better option for this stuff. But it seems like at the same time, if you ever did want to keep stuff in the asset pipeline, well, I guess that's a question. Are you able to use both? Because I was wondering, like, for anybody that uses PropShaft, if a gem like, I don't know, an admin gem adds assets to the asset pipeline, then what happens? If you switch to PropShaft, not have assets anymore. So you'd have to be careful to only use PropShaft when you didn't have any gem dependencies that had assets. I feel like there's a lot of unanswered questions that I need to go play with and see how it works.
I'll be honest, I forgot all about PropShaft. Like, I feel like I've consumed so much asset thoughts the last 2 months that I just, that was one of the smaller things I forgot about.
Yeah, in the README now, it has that. This is what I remembered. PropShaft looks for the specific pattern of -digest.digested.js as the postfix to any asset file as an indication that the file has already been digested. That is a lot of words, but if you have .digested.js, then it will skip adding additional hashes to the end of it. So it sounds like a good way of handling that. I wonder if that'll get introduced into sprockets, because that would be a nice thing to have. And then we could just let images and whatever else go through Parcel or ESBuild or whatever and get digested.
It says at the very bottom that PropShaft will most likely replace sprockets.
But sprockets needs to be supported for a long time to come, blah, blah, blah. Yeah.
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 This is very alpha.
Yeah, that's like Rails 9 kind of thing or something, maybe.
Rails 9, see? The thought.
Yeah. I mean, if we get another major change and just skip a version, we could be there by next year, right?
We're on the way.
I kind of doubt that.
Yeah.
Maybe it's like an option, but I don't know.
Yeah, I wonder how much is blocking Rails 7 at this point. It seems like a lot of the JavaScript and CSS stuff has been solved or is on the verge of being solved. So I don't know. Can't be too far away.
I don't know. I see no indication of such things on the repo anywhere. So
that's actually something I tried to look up before we started recording. And it just seemed like things have just kind of quieted down a little bit.
Yeah, I see a few issues related to regressions.
There was some movement on the data confirm and disable with stuff being added to Turbo directly. But there was also a really cool option to replace. So you know how data disable with is it works on buttons or on, I think it'll work on links or whatever too, but it changes the actual text and then it moves the text to a data attribute or something while it's in that process. The proposed thing from Sean Doyle was really cool, but it only supported buttons, but it would basically have two spans inside of your button. One would be hidden, one would not be. And so he would just swap the CSS classes on them when it goes and disables it. So then you would just have no actual HTML changes. It would just be classes moving or whatever. And I thought that was a really smart way of doing it. It seemed really good. Downside is that an input type submit doesn't allow HTML in the value or in the name of the button. So those are the default when you do a form submit in your Rails forms. So it would be a fairly big change for everybody to go and replace those in their app, but it should all be compatible. So it wouldn't be a bad thing to do that, but it would be probably a breaking change that makes it tough to make that part of Turbo 7. Whatever, or do you just say, hey, screw it, you guys got to make this change? I don't know. It's a hard decision, but seemed like a cool solution to it.
Seems reasonable.
Related, you know how a lot of times on your index, when you have no projects or if you go to Podia, I'm sure you have your brand new user, you sign up and you don't have any courses. You go to the courses page and there's some hey, create your first course. Here's some instructions, where to go. And then when you do have a course, it's a table of courses or something. I was trying to figure out how to cleanly do that with Hotwire broadcasting, and Tailwind to the rescue. It's actually super easy. You can have a div in there and says, if it's the only item in the parent, then it's visible. And then you insert the other ones with broadcast and then it just disappears.
Is that the pseudo selector stuff?
Yeah. It's the only selector or whatever, but you could of course do that with regular CSS. But I thought that was genius because we'll just drop in that placeholder div all the time. We can cache it, whatever. And then voila, anytime a new thing gets inserted, then we're good to go. And we don't have to write any JavaScript for it. That was the big thing that I didn't want to have to write any ERB conditionals. And I really didn't want to have to write any JavaScript to do it, and CSS to the rescue. So
that rules.
Yeah, I thought that was cool. I'll have to do a screencast on it, show it.
It's always interesting, what Tailwind services as possible in CSS that I never knew about. I know what pseudo selectors are. I had no idea that one existed before I saw it introduced in Tailwind. I was like, oh my God.
Yes, there's a lot of cool CSS stuff that you can do these days that I don't really know about because I know all my basics and everything and Flexbox and Grid and whatever else, but I don't get too into the pseudo selectors or whatever. I'm not that much of a front end dev, so not fiddling with the animations that often or whatever. But yeah, pretty cool. I love when you can accomplish something like that that feels like it should be the back end implemented there, but it's not. And it's just a little CSS. Or in this case, literally one class. Anything else? Maybe one day we'll talk about that Phoenix stuff that you promised us several episodes ago.
Yeah, that was dope. And we just railroaded. It never happened. That was out last week.
Ruby on railroaded.
One day I will. It's very fascinating.
Yes.
Once we finish talking about Laravel.
Yeah.
So in 30 years, I'll be ready to. All right. Well, love you all. See you later.
Bye.
All right. Bye.